Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to Season 4 of the Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Avimbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy, a global consulting firm whose main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. My son, Max Avimbola, is co-host of a podcast and a first-year computer science student at Newcastle University. Max interviews with me as much as he can, but he can't join us today because he has a lecture, which is a fair enough excuse, I think, for him not to be interviewing with me. But I promise that Max will be back again very, very soon. Now, today, I am so thrilled to be interviewing a really special lady, someone I met a couple of years ago now through a LinkedIn online training course, wasn't it, Sarah?
Yes.
So it's wonderful to have you. Sarah Conway, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So, Sarah, we know a lot about each other because we met through a LinkedIn program. We're both very, very keen, weren't we, to revamp our LinkedIn profiles and get more out of LinkedIn generally as professionals. But our wider audience may not be aware of you and what you do. So would you mind, in your own words, please, Sarah, introducing yourself to our audience?
Yes. So I'm Sarah Conway, and I'm an ombudsman leader at the Financial Ombudsman Service. Often when you tell people you work at the Financial Ombudsman, you know, they almost look a bit nonplussed, like, what does that mean? So it's a national alternative dispute resolution service. So if consumers in the UK have a problem with a financial services product, they can bring that complaint to the Ombudsman Service, and we'll investigate it and decide if the financial services firm has done anything wrong. And we have legal powers to put things right if we think that a firm has done something wrong. So I've been there for about 10 years now. I absolutely love it. It's a fantastic place to work. And I spent the last 12 years in a variety of regulatory investigations roles. So I'm sure we'll get more into this as the podcast goes along. But I started out really wanting to be a lawyer and doing law at uni and then going to law school. And when I moved to London, I fell into regulatory investigations roles. And I just loved the operational nature of being able to kind of use your legal skills and use those to really investigate what was going on in different scenarios, because I've worked for a number of different regulatory bodies, but also being able to take quite big problems like investigating a series of cases for the social work regulator, for example, and thinking, well, they're based all over the country, how do we best do this? And that's where I found a real passion for people leadership and people management. So at the moment, I'm responsible for about 60 people that work in my department. And I think people leadership and engaging with people is what gets me out of bed and gets me to work in the morning. So coming on this, I'm thinking about the importance of really driving an inclusive culture for the organisation. But I think when you're a leader and the impact that you can have on somebody's experience at work, and thinking about the impact I can have on whether somebody feels included at work, whether we're a diverse organisation, I'm acutely aware of that. And this is a really important topic for me. So I'm really thrilled to be here to talk about it more.
And your passion really, really shines through there, Sarah. I mean, it's just
Thank you.
To hear you talking about inclusive leadership already, you know, in just you introducing yourself. And what a wonderful career journey as well. I mean, what was it that made you not go down the legal practice route, albeit that your legal skills are very much valued in your chosen career path?
It was a range of different things. So I think growing up, I was based just outside Manchester in a very working class town. And as a family, we're kind of working class Irish Catholic family. And we had a very strong matriarch in my family, which was my grandma. And, you know, it was my hero. So she'd grown up in Dublin. She had a scholarship at the Royal College of Music because she was very good at classical piano and particularly Chopin. And I think she'd had her experiences broadened so much by moving away from Ireland, although she missed it terribly. She was always encouraging me from a really young age that where you live is very small and, you know, it's the same people doing the same thing. There's a bigger world out there. You don't have to just stay here. You know, you can do anything that you want to do. Our mother particularly had a very big focus on academic studies. You know, they pushed us a lot. I'm not sure there was a lot of choice in my family about going to uni. You know, I think it was one of my grandmother's biggest regrets that my mother and her brothers hadn't been to university and my grandma hadn't been. They'd not been in a position to go. They really pushed me and my sister to go to uni. And I was on that path of I'm going to go and do, I knew from a very young age I wanted to do law at uni, and I was fascinated with different, you know, documentaries or programs, you know, about anything to do with law. I just loved it. So I knew that I wanted to do that. And I just assumed, well, you know, I'm going to go and do my degree and then I'll do my legal practice course and then I'll get a training contract. And it just did not, as life often does, it didn't work out that way. So when I was in my final year of uni, my father passed away. And it was a really difficult time, because I think in hindsight, if I could go back now, I'd pause that third year, because it's your most important year of study. And I was just trying to get through it because it was such a painful time for me and my family. And I think being away from home, because the other thing that had kind of come from this strong nature of grandmother was, you aren't going to uni in Manchester. You have to go somewhere else, go and find a new city, learn new things, meet new people, expand your horizon. So I'd chosen Liverpool University and studied law there. And then I decided to go back rather than take a break. But I think it compromised my studies a little bit because there was so much going on. I was terribly worried about my mum, about my dad's mum, you know, so there was a lot of back and forth in between. And I did, you know, did fine at uni, but I never felt like it was reflective of me and my ability because of what had gone on. And I think when I moved to London and then you start trying to find training contracts, it becomes difficult, you know, even though I'd gone to a good university. And, you know, I would get, did have a number of interviews, and I was really focused on chasing that training contract down, and it was what I wanted to do, and I felt I'd have a better chance of doing that in London. But when I got to London, I obviously had to work, you know, I had to kind of like fund myself. It's an expensive place to live. And I got a job at the insolvency service, and I just remember kind of getting that job and thinking, oh, there's a different way I could use these skills. And I was there for about 2 years and then went to another regulatory body. And that's when I first started managing people. And I knew from weeks in, I want to be in a job where I manage big teams of people. And I know that that's entirely possible in law. But my options then in terms of, would I go and do that training contract where I'd be kind of working quite possibly a bit more on my own, not doing so much people management. I suppose I questioned, would I be happy? You know, what's going to make me happy? What makes me tick? And it is genuinely working with people and bringing teams of people together to achieve things that I think, if I've learned anything over my career, it's that's what you get, that feeling, don't you? You know, when you're doing good work, you're making a difference to people. So that's probably why I think I didn't go down the legal route. But I think it was also kind of chimed in with how competitive it was at the time. And as much as those grades, you know, I was thinking when I was preparing for the podcast about challenges I faced, and I was thinking, would I say that my kind of university experience, was that the challenge? But I wonder whether actually it was more about my own judgment and perception on the grade. And I think I always felt maybe a bit ashamed of it almost, because you would be surrounded by people with firsts and, you know, different from, you know, from Oxford, Cambridge, wherever. So when you were going into those interview processes, I think I always went in mentally on the back foot, kind of expecting those people went to Warwick and they've got a first. How am I going to compare? It's probably a mixture of two things, really. The fact that I loved something and I found something that I loved and that where I could still use those legal skills. But also I think feeling probably quite, yeah, on the back foot in terms of applying when I was going for those training contracts. I didn't necessarily give up, but when I realised that I could use it elsewhere, I thought, well, this is what I want to do.
So interesting what you say, Sarah, about the mindset being what can ultimately be holding us back, because I seriously, you know, I doubt if any of these other candidates for training contracts that you were interviewing alongside were thinking that of you at all, you know, or even had the, I mean, they were just probably more focused on their own sort of application and how they were going to perform. And quite often, and I've certainly been guilty of this myself, we do compare, don't we, Sarah? You know, we think about all the reasons why it might not work out rather than actually, this is what I've got to offer and this is why it could work out, wouldn't you say?
Completely. You almost wish you knew then what you know now. And I think whenever one thing that I've loved about my career is that when I went into those roles, because I genuinely enjoyed the kind of more operational nature of them and the people leadership nature of them whilst using those skills, because I liked it, I was good at it. Because I was good at it, I would get further opportunities. And I think I know now that if you go into something, and even if you aren't the most qualified person, if you really enjoy it, and then you'll probably be better at it and it'll go well. And you don't necessarily need to have this, oh, well, I just couldn't do that. And I'd never advise anyone that came to me for advice at the moment to say, oh, don't bother doing that. You're not qualified in it. I'd say, well, what skills do you have and how could you bring them to whatever it is you want to focus on? But definitely at the time, it was that mindset of, oh, you know, I don't have this. And I think as women, we're probably more inclined to say, well, when you look at the job description or whatever it is, you think, well, I can't do those two things. And you disregard the six or seven things that you could do. And that definitely played a part in those decisions at that time. And I think how you go into an interview feeling often dictates how the interview goes. Because if, you know, I was going into some of those feeling on the back foot, feeling a bit like an imposter. And then that would have come across, you know, definitely as a young person in an interview process, it would have come across. And, you know, and then I'd get the verbal reasoning or numerical reasoning results and they'd be good. And I'd almost think, well, that's a fluke. You know, I must have just had a good day on those. So it's kind of even in the face of evidence of you being able to do well, you'll disregard it. And I've worked really hard, I would say, you know, working with amazing people like yourself, having conversations with people like yourself and other really inspirational female role models, that it makes you kind of question, why do you ask yourself that? Why is that the first thing that you think? And just becoming more aware of it has made a big difference, I would say, in terms of how I approach things now, whereas, how, you know, compared to how I approach things as a young person in London trying to get a legal career.
That's such a good tip about overcoming that challenge around mindset. And I also really love the themes that are coming through around, you know, the importance of role models, Sarah, very strong female role models. I mean, your grandma sounds absolutely amazing, you know, just so inspiring. Yeah. And those role models are important. But another thing that's very interesting is I, like you, would have said that, yes, indeed, you know, women tend to select themselves out of opportunities, we can be much tougher on each other and so on. But I remember just earlier this week, and by the time this episode comes out, we will be in Women's History Month and it will be March, and we'll be talking about all sorts of things to do with women and workplace, etc. But I spoke this week to a group of young men at school, year 12s, for our global audience. Year 12s would be about 17 years old, 16, 17, 2 years away from going to university. The schools are selective, super selective grammar school, all boys. And there must have been about 200 of them that I was giving this talk to. And I was talking about how my son had noticed at a young age that the girls were selecting themselves out of STEM subjects. And that had made him become, you know, a he for she ambassador for the UN.
Yeah.
And doing all sorts of stuff for women in tech. And he's now student ambassador on his course for computer science and so on. But what was very interesting was I then had a couple of the young men admit to me that actually they had selected themselves out in various ways. And so my assumption that this was a heavily gendered thing, I mean, obviously, this is anecdotal data, a sample size of what, 2 out of 200. I don't know if that's typical or not. If there'd been more girls in the audience, might they have felt that they were more likely to select out? But I wonder actually if we're assuming that for that younger generation, that the girls continue to do that. Because what I'm hearing now is that the girls are really confident and bullshit. It's actually our young men who can sometimes be selecting themselves out. I mean, what are your thoughts on that as a sort of theory, Sarah?
I mean, I'm really pleased that there's a difference there with kind of girls putting themselves forward. But I think what you've mentioned about assumption is probably one of the biggest things that I've reflected on in terms of my own journey around understanding my privilege and allyship, is around not making assumptions of how different things impact different people and how they feel. And we might have assumed for whatever reason or from past experience that, oh, well, you know, the boys in the class, of course, they're going to put themselves forward. But when you stop and listen and you actually seek to understand and, you know, engage with those people themselves, you think, actually, that's completely different to what I thought. So for me, if I think of everything that's come out of, you know, my own allyship journey and what the journey I've been on since George Floyd's murder, is probably that assumption piece is probably the biggest thing that's come out of it for me, in terms of if you get into that space of assuming, you don't do justice by anybody, because you're not actually amplifying anybody else's voice or even tackling the root cause of a problem that you might be able to, because you've assumed it's one thing and actually it might be another. As a people leader, for me, that's a really, really important kind of takeaway from the past 18 months around not assuming. In that situation, you'd want to create a situation where anybody that felt like they just automatically selected themselves out could say, I've selected myself out. Can we have a conversation about why I did that? And then that's where I think you get more equity, because anybody can come to you and talk about it. And I think, you know, almost those assumptions are some of what plays into maybe, you know, males not telling somebody if they feel like that, because it's almost kind of doubly hard because they're thinking, well, I feel like I've got to self-select out, but I also maybe even feel a bit guilty that I've self-selected out because I should be the kind of person that puts myself in. And you make it twice as hard for somebody to have their voice heard. So I think it's incredibly important.
Yeah, no, I love that about challenging assumptions is so, so critical to overcoming our own biases. And with that sort of train of thought, I don't want to make any assumptions about what your typical day looks like, Sarah. What, you know, when you wake up in the morning, what does your day look like? So I'll ask you that question to stop myself from making assumptions. What is a typical day like for you, Sarah? You know, the alarm goes off and then what happens typically?
So no 2 days are the same. That's why I love my job. From kind of turning the alarm off, one of the big things now that I've really got into kind of just before work, and even when I say this, I think, am I about to say this? Do I do this? But got really into just doing 5 or 10 minutes of meditation before kind of getting into work or and going out with the dog, getting some fresh air, doing something so that you, particularly in this weird old situation we've been living through for the past 2 years, getting some headspace for however long you can do, is really, really important to me. So I tend to start my day thinking, how can I have some headspace and clear my head? And then in terms of work, a lot of it is meeting with my team. So I'll be meeting individuals, talking to them about their own progress. I might be meeting teams of people that are working on different pieces of work that I'm leading and reviewing progress, talking about challenges that they might be facing. How can I help remove some of the barriers that are in their way? And then another big part of my job and fills quite a bit of my day is meetings with other regulatory bodies on behalf of the Ombudsman Service and maybe with government firms. So it wouldn't be unusual to meet, for example, a finance firm in the morning and have a call with a regulatory body in the afternoon. So you're dealing with so many different audiences. So you can go from speaking to one person to speaking to a room full of people. And I'm very lucky that in my job, I get to go out and speak at different conferences. And I absolutely love that because you meet so many different people, you hear so many different perspectives. And I think it's important for me as a leader, but also as a leader at the Ombudsman Service, to also check in with how others kind of, what questions do they have? Again, don't assume what people may or may know or what questions they might have. So getting out and doing that kind of external engagement piece as well is a huge part of the day. So yeah, it's always around, I would say, people and a lot of polls. But I love it. And I've taken quite a lot of steps as well this year to make sure that I've got the space in my diary to do the thinking and to get on with the actual work. You know, it's really easy on Zoom, isn't it? You know, to have hours and hours and hours of calls. And then at the end of the day, your dad says you haven't got any energy to speak to your family because you've been on calls for hours and hours. So I've been trying to focus on just, you know, having that headspace too. And also having, I think one of the most fantastic things about the Ombudsman Service and Embrace, one of their employee relations network, they run so many fantastic events. I feel like I get access to go to a TED Talk all the time in terms of they will have so many different speakers and panels coming in talking about their experiences of racism or experiences as an employee. And going and listening to those kind of events is a massive thing for me too, where I feel like I get so much out of that.
Yes, those conversations are so important for raising awareness. And you know, there's nothing beats, Sarah, does it? Listening to someone who has lived experience of yeah. something and they're being very authentic in sharing their message, does it?
No. I think as a, you know, how I see it personally is, when you work with people, and you know, not just because you work with people as a leader and a manager, but we're a public facing service, so we deal with the, you know, with the general public. It's so important to have the headspace and the mindset that you want to go and, you know, find out more, not expecting people to kind of come to you and tell you about their experiences, but thinking about how you can find out more and putting yourself in a position where you become more aware of things that maybe you would not have been aware of before you attended that event or you had that conversation. So for me, you get so much out of it. And I do think, you know, part of being an ally is building knowledge. And I would almost describe it as, you know, trying to be an active and involved but bystander. So, you know, you're giving other people the chance to have a platform to use their voice to educate others when they want to, but also never expecting that from people and just thinking about, well, what work can I do personally too? So, yeah, I completely agree.
So we've already started talking a lot, actually, about allyship and by implication, privilege as well. But I'd love to just take a step back slightly and just ask, in your own words, Sarah, what does privilege actually mean to you? What's your understanding of the word privilege?
I would describe it as situations or characteristics about me personally that mean that I haven't faced the same challenges as somebody because of the colour of my skin, for example. So when I was kind of thinking about privilege last year, when I wrote an article on allyship for our Embrace Network, and I was thinking about, well, what is my privilege? You know, can I find some statistics about that? So, you know, I think when I looked at it and I was looking at statistics from the government, I was more likely to have gone to university than a Black person. You know, I was more likely then to have gone to a Russell Group university. You think about how many jobs have got that must be degree educated in their job profile. So you're then more likely to be able to get into a better paid job. And I think for me, privilege is about, it's almost, I'm not saying that you haven't faced any challenges, but it's understanding and having awareness of the things that haven't made that as challenging as it could have been. For me, it's been about educating myself on what does that privilege mean and, you know, understanding my own privileges, like going to university. So, you know, I think it would have, you could understand somebody thinking, well, you know, I'd had a difficult time at uni, that must have been hard, that's not a privilege. But actually, that's not what privilege is about. It doesn't mean that you haven't faced challenges. It's that they haven't been made worse by the colour of your skin. And I think understanding that topic more and what it meant means that I'm better able to talk to other people about it, but also understand if you overhear conversations where people don't get it, you can kind of explain things in a way that helps people understand. For me, I'm on a learning journey. I'm not perfect. I've got so much to learn and more that I want to learn. And I think admitting when you don't know and when you've got more to learn is so important in this journey as well.
It really is. And frankly, is much appreciated by those who need you to be an ally for them. You know, those who might not enjoy the privilege you have. You know, I know that in situations where I had a very recent example towards the end of last year where both racism and sexism coincided spectacularly once again, unfortunately, in a very traumatic way, I have to say. And it was the allyship that I had from the white men involved in the scenario, frankly, that really, you know, and also from my son. I mean, but the point I'm making is these were all guys who were really like, you know, behind me and saying that, you know, they weren't quite sure how to address the issue, but I'm behind you. How can I support? And so on. So to your point about not always knowing, you know, it's an education, it's an ongoing process. You won't always get it right. I was so grateful for that allyship to get me over what was a truly horrific situation, but I would never want to go through that again. But allyship is critical, isn't it? You've already talked about the importance of listening to the voices of underrepresented groups, taking on board that education piece. But what else does allyship mean to you, Sarah? Because I know it means a huge amount to you.
I think for me, it's about, you know, kind of also advocating for underrepresented groups, not assuming what they may need or what they may want or actually what the challenges are. But I do think it's about kind of challenging different policies and processes and being prepared to have an uncomfortable conversation. And within that, reflecting on your own biases. So when I think about, you know, we've talked a bit about my background and, you know, I was saying to Funky before we started that it really made me reflect on my own upbringing, living in a very small working class town where there was no diversity whatsoever. And then having moved and lived in London, where it's so completely diverse, I think I would have been on my own journey at times with that because, you know, I would have had biases growing up in a completely white working class area and, you know, not being around a range of different people. So for me, it's also taking the time to reflect on your own biases and kind of asking yourself the question I was having a really interesting conversation with somebody recently about, for example, how they might have felt if they walked past a group of young Black men and whether they would just instinctively think, oh no, I'm scared, without kind of questioning the situation. But having that conversation where somebody can say, this might be, this is how I felt, I don't think it's right, you know, and I want to get to the bottom of it. I felt like that was a really important conversation where if you don't create also an environment, and this is another big part of being an ally, if you don't help create an environment where people can get things wrong and they can say, you know, they can talk about their own biases and we can all talk about our own biases, it's far more difficult for people to actually reflect and then for things to kind of, you know, move on and almost be processed. Because otherwise, I think you're internalizing your own opinion or biases that you might have had for years and probably would have been backed in by other people in your family or in your local area. So I think it's about creating an environment where people can have honest, uncomfortable conversations, be active within that, and do the work in terms of reflecting on your own biases too. So for me, that's a big part of allyship. And if I had to use one word, it'd be about learning and continuing to learn, accepting that you don't know. I mean, you don't know much because you've never lived these experiences. Other people have. And that's so important. That's why that assumption point that we just discussed as an ally for me is so important too. Because how can we ever move the conversation forward if we don't reflect on that? And I think the other thing is keeping the conversation going. So in the wake of George Floyd's murder, there's been, rightly so, there's been a lot of global activism and response to it, but we can't let that dwindle in terms of the conversation continuing. And then people just thinking, well, that's done now, we don't need to worry about it, when actually this is an ongoing thing that people face every day in many different ways. And I think now, particularly as a people leader and as a person, I would say that allyship for me means, you know, it's not enough just to not be racist. It's about kind of understanding nuances. So, you know, most people would like to think if they observe something overtly racist, they'd step in. But what about if you observed a microaggression? You know, how might you tackle that? Might even the person involved want you to tackle it? It's made me think it's better to have a conversation with the people involved first to see, well, how was that viewed? Do you want me to kind of take any action? You know, before kind of steaming in and saying, you said X, Y, or Z sort of thing. So it's always taking that step back and thinking, how can you advocate for others and raise up the voice of others and be an active bystander?
Yes, it's just so much that you've said in that, Sarah, that's going to be of huge help to our listeners. You know, I just feel so strongly that the more of these stories we share, you know, we're all in different places when it comes to all of these things. You know, we're all in different stages of our journey around the understanding of privilege, for example. What does allyship mean to me? You know, what am I doing, my organization, my school, whatever it might be? And, you know, we're all in a very different place around diversity and inclusion, of course, and what that might mean to us. So I'd love to get a sense from you, Sarah, about diversity and inclusion. You know, why is it important to you? It's very clear it is, because very early on you started talking about being an inclusive leader and what that meant to you and so on. So why is diversity and inclusion so important to you, Sarah?
So I think firstly, it would be about the how people feel at work is incredibly important to me. And I think that organisations and people, colleagues, whoever are going to be better at their job if they feel included, if they see themselves represented in different groups at different levels of seniority in an organisation. And I think now and going forward, that is going to be where organisations thrive, where people feel included, they feel valued, and they see representation in an organization. And then also, I think as a people leader in an organization that serves the public, it's also about being reflective of the public that you serve. So you need to kind of be diverse and inclusive if you want to better understand what's going on for the people that come to your organization for help. And it's incredibly important for me that the culture in any department that I lead is there so that people have the space to have these conversations that we've talked about throughout, that people have the space to kind of get things wrong, but also actively work on their own biases or themselves. And I think that's probably where people feel happy at work. And I'd love anybody that works in the department that I work in to feel happy when they come into work, to feel valued. and to feel like they belong. And I think, you know, a leader casts a long shadow. So if as a leader, you're not passionate about that, how will anybody else in the department that works for you feel, you know, if that's front and centre of how you work and the kind of culture that you want to create, then I think that's not just going to impact me and impact the people in my direct team. It'll impact people in wider teams and beyond, or the people I come in contact to in the organisation. And without sounding too OTT, I think that's how we make the country and the world a better place in terms of learning from what's happened and years and years of unawareness, maybe, in terms of how racism plays out and the subtlety and nuances around that. And I think through increasing awareness and having that at the front of your mind, that's how we move the conversation on, and we keep moving the conversation on.
That's such an incredible way of putting it, you know, starting with the workplace and what it means to you as a leader and for engagement and just enjoying work, more frankly, to then wider society. You know, like you, of course, I agree that diversity and inclusion has a role to play in all facets of our lives. And it's just been so, so insightful talking to you, Sarah. I mean, we've had many conversations over the last 2 or 3 years, but it's really great to manage to carve out the time to have this conversation, actually, for the podcast as well. I've really, really enjoyed it, Sarah.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's been brilliant talking to you. And I want to say thank you as well for, you know, we've had conversations in the wake of all this, and you've always been so open to having the conversation with me and, you know, listening to your experiences, your career journey. I've benefited so much from that, but this for me feels like a privilege to come and do, to be honest with you, to be interviewed on your podcast. So thank you so much for having me.
My absolute pleasure, Sarah. And with that, lovely listeners, we'll say goodbye for now. Thank you so much for downloading, subscribing. Please continue to rate and like and comment on Apple. You can also rate us on Spotify, which would be absolutely wonderful because it just spreads the reach even more. But really, really grateful, you know, both Max and I are, for your support, lovely listeners, in making our small mother-son project such a huge, huge success globally. And I'll say goodbye for now. And I look forward very, very much indeed to my next truly insightful and inspiring conversation with yet another phenomenal leader, just like Sarah Conway. Thanks very much, everyone, and goodbye for now.